The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
My family to yours, Happy New Year. May this fresh year be your absolute best year.
It's the start of a new year, and one thing that we often do culturally to rein in the new year is New Year's resolutions. And so,
guys, this video is going to be a much, much requested New Year's resolution.
According to the Journal of Clinical Psychology, only 8% of Americans fulfill their New Year's resolution. 8%.
Don't have a vague resolution like, I want to do better in my career. You should figure out the different steps that you can take to make that happen. And one thing that I think can help a lot is to have some sort of role model.
So that you shift from making excuses to revealing results.
And 2014 has arrived, and with it, the first of the year's literary awards, the category winners of the Costa Prizes. They're awarded for fiction, a debut novel, a poetry collection, and a children's book. But it's the biography section that's exciting us here on the Books Podcast. The winner is not only from that unfashionable genre, a cradle-to-grave biography, but it's a biography of an Italian fascist. It's called The Pike, and its subject is Gabriele D'Annunzio, one of the more colourful characters of 20th century political history. With us to discuss it is its author, Lucy Hughes Hallett. Welcome and congratulations, Lucy.
Thank you very much.
Now, you must be getting a bit of an old hand at winning awards. You've already got the Samuel Johnson under your belt.
I can do with as many more as come my way. It's a huge pleasure. And there are obviously a lot of very good things about winning prizes, but one of them is just knowing that there are people out there who've sort of totally got the point of the book and liked what I was doing, it feels good.
I think it's just so counterintuitive that this book would be a great prize winner. And I say this as a huge fan of it, because who knows now about D'Annunzio?
Well, it's a funny thing that you're quite right. It seems that an awful lot of the public want, or anyway publishers think they want, stories that they already know very well. So, you know, they want to read books about Morrissey or David Beckham or Queen Victoria or whatever. But it seems to me a story that you don't already know is perhaps a little bit more exciting.
So tell us the story.
I'm going to start towards the end, because D'Annunzio's great moment on the world stage was in 1919, less than a year after the end of the First World War, when Europe was in a state of some chaos and the peacemakers in Paris are trying to decide which territory of the sort of now defunct Austro-Hungarian Empire should go to which of the victorious superpowers. There was a lot of squabbling, and D'Annunzio, who was a national hero in Italy, a poet who'd become a man of action and kind of spoke up for a particular segment of the kind of Italian right wing, he thought, along with a lot of other Italian nationalists, Italy wasn't getting its fair share, so he set out just to grab a bit. And with just over 200 deserters from the Italian army, he marched into a city which was then called Fiume, which is in Croatia, and announced he was annexing it to Italy. The Italian government were deeply embarrassed by this. It didn't suit their diplomacy at all, so they wanted nothing to do with it. And so D'Annunzio held Fiume for a year and a quarter, during which time he established there a sort of bizarre little kind of utopia or dystopia, it rapidly became, as it descended into kind of, you know, crime and anarchy.
Quite a lot of criminals there. There were also deserters and there were futurists. What part of his vision tied in with the vision of the Italian futurist artists, didn't it?
One of the reasons I wanted to write about D'Annunzio was that he was, although in many ways a deplorable character, he was extremely clever, extremely widely read. He was a futurist decades before Marinetti, the spokesperson for the futurists, coined the word. But, you know, back in the 1880s, when Marinetti was still in the nursery, D'Annunzio was writing an ode to a torpedo. And one idea he shared with Marinetti was the idea that war was a thoroughly good thing, character building, cleansing, and generally to be desired.
Where did this person come from?
Well, he was the son of the mayor of Pescara, which is a fairly small, sleepy place on the Adriatic coast. A busy port, and D'Annunzio's father was a trader who was trading across the Adriatic, you know, sending shiploads of dried fruit and wine backwards and forwards. D'Annunzio grew up with a huge sense of his own importance. You know, he was the mayor's son, he was precocious, he was clever, his father indulged him. But then he was sent off to school in Tuscany, slap bang in the middle of the decade during which Italy came into existence. I mean, in 1860, Garibaldi led his expedition to Sicily, beginning the process that we now call the Risorgimento, which ended in 1870 when Italy became free and united. So D'Annunzio grew up against the background of this huge sort of historical upheaval. And he would have heard the grown-ups talking about it, obviously. And from very early on, as I say, he was very precocious, he saw himself as the great poet, which he never had any doubt that that's what he was going to be, who was going to give a voice to the new Italy, because a new nation needs a new culture, and he would be its literary star.
And he was a real literary star, wasn't he?
Absolutely, absolutely. Published his first volume of verse, aged 16, while he was still at boarding school. And one of the things he was terrifically good at was self-promotion. D'Annunzio grasped immediately that he was growing up in the sort of first age of the mass media. Printing was cheaper and more efficient than it had ever been before. Newspapers, journals were springing up all over the place. He would use this. And so, age 16, as I say, still at school, his second volume of verse was ready for publication. He was fantastically fast working. He sent an anonymous telegram to the editor of a journal in Florence, informing the editor of the tragic death in a riding accident of that brilliant young prodigy, Gabriele D'Annunzio. The editor was taken in, published the story. It was picked up and repeated in newspapers here, there and everywhere. You know, lots of sort of think pieces about the terrible loss to Italian literature. What might this brilliant boy not have done if only he'd had time? D'Annunzio waited it out for over a week before sending a second telegram, signed this time, reproaching the editor for having caused such terrible distress to himself and his family, magnanimously saying that he wouldn't, after all, sue him. And it worked. I mean, he never looked back. He was very soon a highly respected poet, and then in his 20s he became a best-selling novelist, and then later in life he started writing plays.
Now, the subtitle of this book is Poet Seducer and Preacher of War. We've dealt with the poet and the preacher of war. What about the seducer?
Yes, he was astonishingly successful with women. And I say astonishing because he really was not a beauty. He was quite small. He had lovely curly hair in his teens, but he rapidly went bald. There was something about him which a lot of women found intensely exciting. A lot of men found it absolutely repellent. There was something sort of sexually ambiguous about his physical presence. He was a sort of little, rather feminine man with...
with bad teeth.
Terrible teeth, terrible teeth. One woman, you know, on whom he tried his charms, successfully, I think, wrote afterwards that she'd never before met a man who had teeth in three colours, white, yellow and black. He was a brilliant talker. Even people who detested him had to admit that he had a great gift, both for sort of public oratory, but also for intimate conversation. And several people have described what it felt like to be seduced by D'Annunzio, one of them being Isadora Duncan, the dancer, who was very, very funny about it, who said that he had a way of sort of, you know, leaning in close and, you know, gazing deep, deep into your eyes until you felt that you were the only person on the planet, and that you had all his attention. He had this great gift for appearing to devote himself entirely to the person to whom he was speaking. Actually, people who knew him very well were aware that he was quite capable of giving this impression while his mind was completely elsewhere, composing a poem or planning his next seduction. He liked his women to be rather distinguished, and many of them were. D'Uzo was the greatest actress of her generation, with the possible exception of Sarah Bernhardt, with whom he also had a quick fling. But with D'Uzo, they lived not actually together, to observe the proprieties. They had sort of next door houses. He made her absolutely miserable. He always enjoyed seeing his women cry, and he wrote late in life, after she'd died, that one of the things he'd most loved about her was the way that when he made her cry, she had a very sort of graceful gesture of wiping her tears up onto her temples. And that was one of his treasured memories of her.
It's a cradle-to-grave biography, but it actually employs a biographical style that is very fresh and original. And you talk about using the techniques of fiction.
I wanted it, well, to be as gripping as a novel. Of course, why not? I'm sort of shocked, really, by how boring an awful lot of non-fiction books are. I mean, you know, there seem to be far too many writers who think it's OK just to go off to the library, absorb a lot of information, and then, you know, having gobbled it up, then sort of spew it forth again. And I do read a lot of fiction. I think maybe more biographers and historians should spend more time reading fiction, actually, because our readers are very well able to cope with quite complicated time schemes. You know, there aren't very many novels that just begin in the beginning and plod through to the end. Or indeed, there aren't many films or television drama that do that. You know, the public is certainly up to, you know, flashing back and forth and different points of view. And one of the things that drew me to D'Annunzio was that there is such a wealth of material that I was able to use a lot of different voices in this book. So, you know, when I got bored of my own narrative voice or D'Annunzio's voice, I could, you know, all of a sudden be quoting Franz Kafka or André Gide, or, you know, there were a lot of other people I could draw on. I couldn't actually just begin at the beginning. If you're writing a book about Napoleon, you could do that because you don't really have to say who Napoleon is, because you can be pretty sure most of your readers will know. So I had to grab the reader at once. I had to almost tell the whole story right up front. You know, after a sort of an introductory chapter, I then tell the whole story of his life in chapter two by means of sort of snapshots, sightings, you know, different accounts of him by different people. And it was only once I'd kind of got that out of the way that I thought I could then, you know, go back to the beginning, knowing that my readers would be able to appreciate some of the kind of the ironies and the sort of nuances of the story I was telling, because they would have in their mind where it was going.
And this is a monumentally unhappy ending in a way, isn't it? I mean, monumental, yeah, in the literal sense of the word.
After Fiume, which was his big moment, he described it himself as being the episode towards which all his life had been leading. He was in his late 50s when he went to Fiume. And then after it, he kind of withdrew from public life. He carried on writing. And he lived for 18 years in a bizarre house on Lake Garda, which is still there very much as he left it, and devoted those last years of his life to transforming that house into a kind of complex piece of installation art in glorification of himself. Mussolini was very anxious about D'Annunzio, because in 1922, when Mussolini seized power, D'Annunzio actually had a much bigger following among Italian nationalists than Mussolini himself did. And Mussolini was uncomfortably aware that should D'Annunzio come out of retirement and try to sort of take over the role that Mussolini had sort of allotted himself, D'Annunzio would very likely succeed. And so Mussolini told one of his friends and followers, if you have a bad tooth, what you do is you cap it with gold. And that's what I'm doing with D'Annunzio. So, you know, basically bribed him to stay out of public life and gave him this extraordinary sequence of presents, including a motorboat, an aeroplane, and most bizarrely of all, half a real warship, which is now in the garden of D'Annunzio's house, which is on the side of a mountain above Lake Garda. So it's set into the hillside, so it juts out into thin air above the lake. It's a bizarre sight. And it came complete with a set of real-life sailors whom D'Annunzio used to drill on its deck.
And meanwhile, he was more or less under house arrest.
Yes. D'Annunzio realised that Mussolini had planted spies in the village to keep an eye on him. He boldly said to Mussolini, I would like to have a protector in my household. And so a sort of fascist official was stationed in D'Annunzio's household. And D'Annunzio set about charming him very successfully, you know, got jobs for his brothers and cousins and so forth. And so this guy became, I mean, certainly he was spying on D'Annunzio and reporting back on everything D'Annunzio said. But it's noticeable that his reports, which have survived to Mussolini on what D'Annunzio is up to, are very friendly towards D'Annunzio and tend to say, look, you know, don't worry, he's not a danger, you don't have to, you know, don't be hard on him, let him have what he wants. And Mussolini, on the whole, let D'Annunzio have everything he asked for apart from an airstrip. The one thing he wasn't going to be allowed to do was get away.
Lucy Hughes Hallett there. The Pike is published by Fourth Estate. Lucy will be contending with four other writers for the Costa Book of the Year at the end of the month, and there are many more awards to come, among them the New Folio Prize set up last year in competition with the Man Booker. Of course, the Booker itself will be different as it's open to Americans for the first time this year. Here to discuss these and other developments of the new year and to give us a quick glimpse of the books coming down the line are Benedicta Page, deputy editor of the Bookseller magazine, and Richard Lee from the Books Desk. Ben, welcome.
Thank you.
Do you think the Booker change is going to make a difference? I know a lot of publishers are quietly hand-wringing.
Yes, I think it is going to make a sizable difference. The Man Booker is, you know, the premium literary prize, and it's always been open to the Commonwealth. And this year it's going to be open to any book published in the UK, but written in English from anywhere in the world. The Folio Prize, sponsored by the Folio Society, also has the same entry requirement. The argument, of course, is that this takes away from the parochial nature of the prize. They are concerned that British novelists and novelists from elsewhere in the Commonwealth are going to be perhaps marginalised by some of the American big hitters. Now, we don't know whether this is going to be the case or not. We don't know whether it's going to be like the BAFTAs, where the American always seems to get shortlisted, but the win goes, goes closer to home. But I think it is going to change the feel of the prizes and the feel of the debate around the prizes.
Richard, one point about this that I'm surprised nobody's drawn attention to is how much it's totally marginalising literature published in other languages. The Folio doesn't accept writing in translation. No. So you know, effectively we're saying the world is American and English.
It's kind of slightly weird, isn't it, that we're allowed to read books from all over the world, but only if they're written in English, because in some sense a translated book doesn't count as writing. I mean, it's translation's always had this kind of problem with its image, the idea that you're not getting the real book in some sense in a translated work. But I think I reckon if you're going to throw open the doors to books around the world, why not throw open the doors to any book anywhere? I mean, why not admit translators as well, like The Impact does, and comes up with some tremendous lists, some excellent winners, some marvellous books.
We do on the Guardian First Book Prize.
As
and we've
you say.
Had some, we've found some great stuff. Ben, tell us more about what the big picture is this year. We were told last year was the year of self-publishing and of the e-book, although I gather the e-book has gone a bit flat, has it? Is that true?
No, that's not true. E-book sales haven't flattened. They're still growing, but it's just that the rate of growth, which was absolutely phenomenal the year before last and last year, is starting to slow down a bit in this country, sort of following the same pattern that it has in the US. But it's still very, very strong, very important part of publishing. But publishers are talking more again about how pleased they are about the resilience of print as well. Print has seen a bit of a drop in the last year, but it's still very, very strong. People still want to read physical books. I think what we will see is a bit of a shift because there are so many tablet devices now, and publishers are very interested in making the most of the movement to tablet devices and also to mobile phones. So we did see some things published last year that were kind of intended to be read like that, and I think we'll see a lot more of that in 2014. Self-publishing, yes, I think that genie is out of the bottle in a way. There are a plethora of platforms. I think you really have to think of it now more as a sort of mixed picture. It's not so much traditional publishing versus self-publishing. It's a kind of interplay between all of them. So you'll get writers, say, for example, like Susan Hill, who's very established, been published for a very long time, putting out a Kindle single or whatever. You'll see writers getting an audience on an online platform like Wattpad and being snapped up by the mainstream publishers. You'll see a real mix of those things.
Let's move on now to the books that we have in store, which is what really excites us. Richard, last year was quite quiet for the big hitters in literary fiction, wasn't it?
Well, there's a terrific amount coming. I mean, straight away, we've got Christos Tsolkas, I'm not sure if I'm saying it right, who made such an impression with The Slap last time around. He's already out with Barracuda, which is a kind of about a boy who has a great swimming career ahead of him and messes it all up and then discovers what life is really about. That's out already. But looking further ahead, there's Laurie Moore coming with a new collection of short stories, and something I'm particularly looking forward to in September, which is a new novel from David Mitchell. It's the first novel in 4 years from the author of Cloud Atlas. You may remember there was a film of that just recently. And this one is described as being a rich and strange story. It's about a woman's life from the 1980s to ecological disaster coming in the mid-21st century. And I'm just fascinated to see what he comes up with. Last time round was the Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, which was his kind of early formalism was very much more in subject to what he calls the human muck. There's also a follow-up from Sarah Waters to The Little Stranger, which is called The Paying Guests, due in October, which finds a genteel widow bereaved by war taking in lodgers of the clerical class and finding her house and family, it says, shaken to the core. It should be a lot of fun, I'm sure.
Ben, March is a hugely strong month, isn't it? Well, actually, I want to read pretty much everything that's being published in March. You were interested in the Damon Gulgut.
It's called Arctic Summer. And apparently it is a really phenomenal novel. I'm hearing very, very good things about it. Damon Gulgut, obviously, he's twice been shortlisted for the Booker Prize, South African novelist. But here his subject is the writer E.M. Forster. And in particular, Forster's travels to India and his experiences there and the effect that they had on him. Arctic Summer, I didn't know, but apparently this is the original title that Forster first intended to call A Passage to India. That was his first title for the book. It's very much about Forster's struggles with his own sexuality, and apparently he also had a sort of epiphany of some kind in the caves, just as the character does in A Passage to India. And yet it was 12 years later that he actually published the book, 12 years after his 1912 visit to India. And apparently this is a really wonderful exploration of creativity, one novelist writing about another. Huge hopes for it, I believe.
Another one is Emma Donoghue's Frog Music. And Emma Donoghue, people will remember from Room, which was shortlisted for various prizes and indeed won several international prizes, which was sort of a rough fictionalisation of the Fritzl case. This is a return to her historical burlesque, which is where I first came to know about her. Like Room, it's based on a true story set in San Francisco in the late 19th century in a stifling heat wave and a smallpox epidemic. Richard, there is also the first of three previous Guardian First book winners is publishing a novel in her new novel in March.
Well, she's not the first, kind of calendar-wise, because Donald Ryan, who won just last year, publishes his second novel, which actually he wrote first, The Thing About December, just now. I think it's out now, this month. This is the book that he wrote before his first book award winning, The Spinning Heart, and is an account of Ireland before the crash. So, I mean, I think a lot of people will be looking forward to seeing what he made of the boom before the bust.
And there's also Philip Gurevich's follow-up. And it is a follow-up, isn't it, to his brilliant...
He goes back to the massacre, yeah.
No, to the Rwandan massacre. Yeah. With another very long title, You Hide That You Hate Me and I Hide That I Know, Living With It in Rwanda, which follows one of the best titles ever, actually, I think. We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families. And this is going to be, I should imagine, a book of real stature, and it's out in April.
Also in March, in fact, there is a new book from Ben McIntyre, the historian who has explored a number of stories of secret agents, Operation Mincemeat from the Second World War. And now he's back with a study of, if you like, the double-crossing daddy of them all, Kim Philby. Kim Philby, a spy among friends. This sounds amazing, very, very interesting. He's done a lot of research, apparently, and new records have come forth.
And moving forward into the summer, Richard, we've got a new Martin Amis.
Yes, can we just hoik back a minute? Just because we mentioned Laurie Moore with the collection of stories due in March as well. But there's also Ben Marcus's collection of stories, Leaving the Sea, published by Granta. He's an author we've interviewed before on the podcast. And this collection includes a story which he published in The New Yorker called Rolling Wood, which is an extraordinary kind of brutal tale. And there's also Tehu Cole. I'm not sure if I'm saying Tehu right. A writer whose Open City in 2011 told the story of an immigrant in New York and won praise from all over the place. He's kind of doing the reverse with his book Every Day is for the Thief, which is the story of a man returning to Nigeria, which apparently was published before in Nigeria in 2007, before Open City was even written. But it promises to be a kind of portrait of transforming Nigeria, which has been in the news all week as one of the mint countries. So it's this kind of novelistic portrait of this country under revolution, again, due in March. But as you say, in the summer, there's Richard Powers' Orfeo, aging composer and biochemist who finds himself on the run from Homeland Security because of some of his experimentation. Sounds fascinating. And of course, there's Carmilla Shamsi's God in Every Stone, a fragment of which appeared in the Granta Best of British Novelists selection, which is a story about the Indian soldiers fighting for the British Army in the First World War. And it's, the fragment in Granta showed her usual kind of combination of this historical breadth and this compassion, which we saw in Burnt Shadows. There's even a new Stephen King, Mr. Mercedes, promises to be a suspense thriller about a retired cop investigating a cold case, a guy who crashed into a line of people and is threatening to kill again.
But Ben, the real big hitters are in the autumn, aren't they, mainly?
I mean, there's one that I'm particularly excited about, which is a new full-length book from Michel Faber, his first since The Crimson Petal and The White, which is around a decade ago now. I mean, he did publish a shorter kind of novella type, The Fire Gospel, more recently. But this, I think, is going to be, though apparently not quite the size of The Crimson Petal, which did break a few bags and arms when it was published. This is going to be a very substantial piece, apparently. It's called The Book of Strange New Things. It's coming right towards the end of the year. The publisher is being a little bit mysterious about what they will tell me about it at present. I'm told it has strong contemporary resonances, but apparently it opens with a man who's saying goodbye to his wife before setting out on a perilous journey as a Christian missionary.
Now, there are also novels from, as previously announced, Martin Amis. Then we've also got Ali Smith. We've got Sarah Waters' Colm Tóibín, a novel called Nora Webster, set 10 years after Brooklyn, his previous novel, Brooklyn. Let's move on to non-fiction. Ben's already mentioned Ben McIntyre. Richard, what do you see ahead of us?
Well, there was a lot of neuroscience in the mind last year. I suppose probably it's one of those subjects that as brain research advances, there'll be a continual stream of them as we get more and more understanding of how our brains are put together. There's a lot last year, and there's going to be more this year, I think. There's a slightly more science fiction-y angle on it from Michio Kaku, who is actually a physicist. He's a superstring theorist who dabbles with popular science in a slightly kind of speculative kind of vein. And he's moving this kind of brand of speculation towards the kind of the future of the mind, how current research indicates where we might be able to expand our cognition. There's a book out just actually this month from D.F. Swab, which is already a bestseller in Holland, out from Alan Lane as well, I think, called We our brains, which are very much more kind of where we're at now, kind of state of play. He goes through the changes of brain from kind of infants through childhood, through your life and up till kind of dementia and decay, exploring what it is to be human and kind of questions of ethics, what this means about our responsibility through the lens of recent brain research, which is a much less sort of science fiction-y take on where we're at, if that's more your kind of thing.
So we've also got a lot of political books Hoving interview, and I'm not talking about Westminster memoirs here, I'm talking about sort of books that passionately embrace the sort of what's the state of politics on the world stage. And they include Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot, and that's by Marcia Gessen. And there are also two books about the NSA case, very dear to the Guardian's heart, No Place to Hide by Glenn Greenwald, who broke the story for us, which is an account of Edward Snowden. And then our own Luke Harding is going to follow with The Snowden Files, The True Inside Story of the World's Most Wanted Man, which is going to be interesting to see how we square up to ourselves, as one might say. And there's Alistair Gray is dealing with Scottish independence, which is going to become a bigger and bigger issue towards the end of the year.
There's also a sudden flood of books about the collapse of capitalism a few years after the credit crunch, with James Rickard's The Death of Money. He's a media banker and the author of The Currency Wars, which was published in 2011. And there's also The Age of Nothing from Peter Watson, published by Phoenix, also due in June, which is a kind of historical perspective on the collapse through the kind of the death of God, Nietzsche, and it claims that we're entering a new era. But for me, perhaps the most interesting of these is a slim book by Benjamin Kunkel, who you may remember his first novel, which was published in 2005, called Indecision, and is also the co-founder and the editor of N+1 magazine. It's called Utopia or Bust. It's a kind of novelistic take on what he calls the shallow revival of Marxism, which the crash provoked. It's kind of a personal exploration of what's going on, I think, which it looks like it's going to be fascinating.
Richard, there are also a few quite a few climate books, aren't there? Naomi Klein, who is the darling of literary political activists, is turning her attention to climate change. And we've got a new James Lovelock, very chillingly saying, posing the question of whether actually it's too late to save Gaia, whether we've blown it already.
Yeah, the publishing industry carries on putting out books of doom about this, because doom is around the corner. There's a book by Peter Limbury from Bloomsbury called Farmageddon about kind of the terrible disaster that industrial farming is wreaking on the landscape. And it's very much the question of the bell that's always ringing. When are we going to wake up? I remember there's a book we covered a couple of years back, which was already saying it's too late to turn things around. But here we are. Maybe Naomi Klein can wake us all up to it.
Oh, it's all too gloomy, isn't it? Now, let's leave on a positive note and come up with the book that we personally are most looking forward to. Richard, what's your tip?
Well, I'm looking forward to another uplifting read from Paul Murray, the author who you may remember of Skippy Dies, which was a novel set in a school about Dublin kids who had kind of been left to the side by parents obsessed with money. This is another book about the boom, which I think is due later in the year. I think it's due in September. I'm looking forward to that immensely.
Ben?
It's Sarah Waters that Richard mentioned earlier that's really got me keen and eager. The Paying Guest, just with a title, I'm already intrigued. She seems to manage to pick up on titles that have something just a little bit uncomfortable about them. And instantly, you're keen. We're told that it's vintage Sarah Waters in every way, and I'm thoroughly looking forward to that.
And it's in the territory of The Little Stranger, isn't it, in the historical territory?
So, that's right. This particular one is set in about 1922.
Oh, so it's gone back earlier.
It's gone back earlier. You know how she does dot around? Very much with a feeling of the aftermath of the First World War and the loss of all the menfolk.
Well, I'm going to mention two, because it's, as I said before, it's such a rich year. I can't restrict myself to one. And one is coming in April, and it's Lost for Words, and it's from Edward St. Aubyn. And it's a satire of literature, celebrity culture and ambition. So it's moving away from his great series of novels, autobiographical novels. I'm going to be really interested to see where he goes now. And the other one, coming in May, is from Mary and Brian Talbot, who scored a huge success with their graphic memoir of growing up as the daughter of a biographer and growing up in the shadow of James Joyce. And this new book is called Sally Heathcote, Suffragette. And that's all from us for this week. Thanks to Richard and Benedicta, to Lucy Hughes Hallett. I hope that you all enjoyed our Digested Year series over Christmas. If you haven't heard them, go to our site at theguardian.com/books and click on the podcast button. Or why not give yourself a New Year treat and become a subscriber to this podcast? It's all free. Next week, we'll be discussing heroines in literature. But for now, from Claire Armistead and my producer, Tim Mabey, goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.